All right, I invite you to turn with me to 2 Kings chapter 5. We're doing a study in our auditorium class here on the kings of Israel, but we've gotten to the place in 2 Kings where it's not quite chronological. All the miracles of Elijah and Elisha, for the most part, are kind of grouped together at the end of 1 Kings and the beginning of 2 Kings. And so, some of these things happened, at different times during different kings, obviously. But in 2 Kings 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and maybe into chapter 7, it's just kind of a grouping of several of the miracles of Elisha. So last week we talked about 2 Kings chapter 5. We talked about the healing of Naaman. Naaman had leprosy, and that in that day was considered incurable. Hearing the diagnosis that you have leprosy was akin to saying you have a terminal illness in our terminology today. So ultimately, the servant girl said, there's a prophet in Samaria that can help you. The king sent his Naaman, who's the captain of the guard, his right-hand man, head of the military, down to the king of Israel, who assumed it was a ploy to pick a fight. And Elisha the prophet says, have you forgotten, that there's a God in Israel? Send him to me. When he was sent to Elisha, he didn't even bother to go out and meet him personally. He just sent instructions because just as today, God has always required faith and obedience. And so he went and dipped in the Jordan 7 times and he was clean. Okay, so we have Elisha's direction. We have Naaman's deliverance. I could have put healing, but deliverance alliterated with my outline. Okay, but that's where we left off last week. Was with the healing. He came back then in verses 16, 17, and 18, and he offered big money to Elisha as payment for this, as a thank you. Elisha refused everything. He wouldn't take a nickel. He wouldn't take anything from him because all of the pagan prophets, it was a pay-for-play type scheme. Okay, small miracle, small price. You need a big miracle. It's going to cost you more. And so he wanted them to understand that there was a distinction between the true prophet of God and the pagan prophets. So Naaman asked for some dirt to take back home. It wasn't just a souvenir. It was a pagan mindset that, gods were gods of locations, whether it was the god of this valley or the god of this mountain or the god of this country or whatever. And, gods had, they had power in certain places, but so along with that, they had to be worshipped in their territory, so to speak. So he wanted to take some dirt home so that he could worship God on an altar built on his home soil. I mean, obviously it's not the way it works, but, this is his pagan mindset and he's just starting to learn things. So that's where we left off in verse number 19. We're going to pick up now in verse 20 of chapter 5 this morning. But Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, said, behold, my master has spared Naaman the Syrian and not receiving at his hands that which he brought. But as the Lord liveth, I will run after him and take somewhat of him. Now, did you catch the need there that they had, that could be met by what he was going to get from Naaman? There was a specific project that they had going at the ministry that, was underfunded that needed help, right? There was a particular budget shortfall that this could meet, that he was trying to, meet a specific need, right? Mm-mm. What does it say there? I don't know why Elisha wouldn't take some of it, but he brought that money down here intending to spend it. He meant to leave it here, so I'm going to help him with that. Okay? That's a little bit like all of the entertainment places in a tourist trap vacation spot. They figure people came figuring on spending money on vacation, so they're going to help you with that. But the motivation here is not ministry-minded in any way. It's just greed, selfishness. Verse 21, Gehazi followed after Naaman. And when Naaman saw him running after him, he lighted down from the chariot and said, is all well? And he said, all is well. My master has sent me, true or false? That's a lie. My master has sent me, saying, behold, even now there become to me from Mount Ephraim 2 young men of the sons of the prophets. Give them, I pray thee, a talent of silver and 2 changes of garments. And Naaman said, be content, take 2 talents. Now, we stop right there. How much money are we talking about? A talent is a measure of weight, Okay, because it doesn't compare with our system, sometimes we just kind of zone out and skip over to the next word that we recognize, you know. But a talent was a measure of weight. You're talking about 75 or 80 pounds in our measurements today. You want to know how much money that is? Convert 80 pounds to kilograms and then look up what bulk silver is going for per kilogram. I mean, this is, you know, thousands of dollars. That, you know, two talents, you're talking about 150 pounds of silver. And it's sold typically by the ounce, bulk silver by the kilogram. Okay, so you're talking about a lot of money here. So what was true about Gehazi's statement up to this point? Did two sons of the prophets come unexpectedly? No. Did his master send him? No. Is any of this true? No. It's a story he made up to make it kind of sound spiritual, that he was going to help relieve him of some of the money he was planning to spend. Verse 23, Naaman said, "Be content and take two talents." And he urged him, and he bound two talents of silver in two bags with two changes of garments and laid it upon two of his servants, and they bare them before him. Naaman even sent men to carry the silver back to Elisha's house. Verse 24, when he came to the tower, he took them from their hand, bestowed them in the house, and he let the men go, and they departed. Verse 25, and he went in and stood before his master. And Elisha said unto him, "Whence comest thou, Gehazi?" And he said, "Thy servant went no whither." You'd think he would know better by this point than to try to lie to Elisha, right? But just because kids should know better than trying to lie to their parents, does that stop them from trying? Not always. You know, just because you should know better than to try to talk the officer out of it, sometimes you do it anyway. He should have known better. But I mean, I just picture this. Where have you been? Nowhere. He's caught. But God had revealed this to Elisha. Verse 26, and he said unto him, "Went not mine heart with thee when the man turned again from his chariot to meet thee? Is it a time to receive money and to receive garments and olive yards and vineyards and sheep and oxen and men servants and maid servants?" In other words, all the things that the money could buy. Is this the time for this? Now, I've tried to lay the foundation here by saying Elisha refused for a particular reason. It's not that he could not have invested that money, okay? It's not that there weren't places it could have been used. In fact, guess what happens in chapter 6? The next story in chapter 6 is the sons of the prophets needed a new dorm. They didn't have enough room. And so were there places it could have been invested? Sure. But that wasn't the point. The point was Elisha wanted this pagan to understand that the God of Israel was different, that the prophets of the true God were different from the pagan prophets. And now Gehazi has undercut all of that with his greed and his selfishness. What is his judgment? So we see here Gehazi's discipline. Verse 27, "The leprosy therefore of Naaman shall cleave unto thee and unto thy seed forever." And he went out from his presence a leper as white as snow. Was that worth two talents of silver and two new suits? Two new outfits for the ladies, whatever you choose to make that entail. No, it wasn't worth it. It's interesting to me, the last phrase, "as white as snow." Because in Leviticus, there were specific instructions given for the priests on how to look at a sore and to determine if it was leprous or not. In certain cases, there was a white spot rising in it and that kind of thing. But if he went out white as snow, that meant he was pretty much covered. In other words, God gave him instantaneously fully developed leprosy, not the beginning stages of it. Okay? He got the full-blown version. What did that mean in the society of Israel if a person was leprous? Ostracized, outcast. Could they go and do business? No. Could they go to the market? No. I mean, there was a leper's camp a lot of times, and sometimes people would kind of take food and leave it out there in a basket or whatever, or send provisions by a messenger type system, but he socially he's done. If he has a family, we're not told anything about Gehazi's family, but if he has a family, he's not going to be able to interact with them anymore. He's not going to be able to do business anymore. He's lost his ministry, right? This is the same Gehazi in chapter 4 when Elisha said, "What can we do for the Shunammite woman?" And you know, she wouldn't tell him, but he said, you know, she doesn't have a son. He had seen miracles. He had some discernment and some perception. He was, you know, he was not, you know, without opportunity. And yet he threw it away for, well, in our terminology, we would say dollar signs. Okay, he threw it away for silver and new clothes and the trappings of wealth and increase. In 1 Timothy chapter 3, in the middle of the list of the qualifications for, you know, the man of God, it's, you know, there's several things: vigilant, sober, good behavior, given to hospitality. And then there's a phrase in there that says, not greedy of filthy lucre. Okay, it doesn't say work for free. That's not what it means. But there's a difference between, you know, working to meet needs, working to provide for your family, trying to set, do something for retirement or those kinds of things. There's a difference between that and the answer that was made famous by, I believe it was Bill Gates, you know, years and years ago, when, you know, he had crossed the $1 billion threshold. He had several $1 billion to his name. And somebody asked him one time, well, how much is enough? What was the answer? You know it? Just a little bit more. Just one more. Just a little bit more. That is an indicator, a symptom, if you will, of greedy. Instead of, I have enough, you know, I've got sufficient, it was, I could, you know, I'll always take some more. I never have enough, even if I can't spend it all. It blows my mind sometimes. I've heard the math on it. I know you didn't come to Sunday school for math necessarily, but I've heard the math on, you know, if you had $1 million and you had to spend it in a week, you know, in ordinary matters, it'd be difficult to do sometimes. You know, spend so many thousands of dollars a day. I mean, you buy a house and a car, and then what are you going to do with it, you know? But at a certain point, you have enough to function. Gehazi here, now, was he living, you know, comfortably? House that's paid for and a retirement plan and, you know, all of those things. It doesn't seem like it. You know, it seems like following around with Elisha, it was kind of, in our terminology, paycheck to paycheck and maybe more love offering basis than salary. But it doesn't matter if you're in a ministry position like Gehazi or in a, you know, regular job type type of occupation, we're all susceptible to that temptation. But when we trade greed for God's will, it's never going to go well. I mean, what does that look like today? I mean, nobody's offering me, you know, 150 pounds of silver for a miracle. What does that look like? Well, maybe that looks like moving my family exclusively because there's more zeros on the paycheck without any regard for how it impacts the kids or what's the church situation where we move or, you know, the other considerations like that. You know, maybe it's taking the promotion that means I work 112 hours a week and there's more zeros, but I never see my wife or kids. You know, there's a lot of ways in which that can translate into modern day, but what did Gehazi lack that he needed? Can we run a list of here's all the things that they didn't have? No. Was God taking care of Elisha? Yeah. I mean, if God fed Elijah at the brook with ravens, then, you know, he was going to be taking care of Elisha and whatever. Does that mean that Elisha had the nice chariot? No, he had the 1970s VW Bug probably. Or he walked. But God was taking care of him. And it's easy to, you know, lose that focus. But Gehazi was judged severely for this. He had an opportunity and he threw it away. it's a reminder to all of us. Number one, we're coming up on the Thanksgiving season. It kind of blows my mind. Thanksgiving's a week and a half. You know, where it was September the 15th, about 3 days ago. Where did it go, right? But, you know, particularly in the Thanksgiving season, but year-round, it reminds us to be thankful, but to reflect on how God's provided, how God's taken care of us, right? You know, if you are greedy, you're not content. You know, if you're content, you know, you're not going to be giving in to greed. You can't be both at the same time. So here, Gehazi was disciplined harshly. He lost his family. He lost his ministry. He lost, you know, his social interaction. He was given a death sentence. He was a relatively young man, we would expect, you know, based on the description that we're given. And he threw it all away for what he thought would be some easy money that he had to gain by deception. If you have to gain it by deception, God's blessing is not on it. So you have here in the miracles of Elisha, the story of Naaman, and wrapped into that is the discipline of Gehazi. That brings us to 2 Kings chapter 6. 2 Kings chapter 6, verses 1 through 8 here. This is various and sundry descriptions, well, 1 through 7. But you have, sometimes you have, you know, Elisha makes the axe to swim, because that's the wording of the text, or recovering a lost axe, whatever. But let's read these verses together. And the sons of the prophets said unto Elisha, behold now, the place where we dwell with thee is too straight for us. Let us go, we pray thee, unto Jordan, and take thence every man a beam, and let us make a place there where we may dwell. And he answered, go ye. And one said, be content, I pray thee, and go with thy servants. And he said, I will go. So he went with them. And when they came to Jordan, they cut down wood. But as one was felling a beam, the axe head fell into the water, and he cried and said, alas, master, for it was borrowed. The man of God said, where fell it? And he showed him the place, and he cut down a stick and cast it in thither, and the iron did swim. Therefore said he, take it up to thee. And he put out his hand and took it. So, is this a miracle? Absolutely. What are the circumstances here? What is the context? The sons of the prophets said, the place where we dwell is too straight for us. That word straight, the word straight with no G-H in it, okay, what does that term mean? Narrow or tight, okay? It's too tight. It's too small. Now, we talked a couple of chapters ago about, it was in chapter 2 when we were talking about the route that Elijah and Elisha took when they kind of made the stops and visited the sons of the prophets before Elijah was translated. They're up near Mount Carmel, up in the north. There was a spot where it seems like Elijah would meet with people, and then there was one in Samaria, and then there was one in Gilgal, and then there was a spot in Jericho, right? So there were several spots where they were the sons of the prophets. These were simply the ones that gathered to learn from the prophets. They desired to, you know, have the ministry. They, maybe some of them would have God's hand on them as a prophet at one time. It seems like in 2 Kings chapter 2, they knew that Elisha was going to have Elijah removed that day. But what they said was, we need another dorm. We need a bigger living space. Okay. Now, which one of these was it? Based on the fact that they said, let's go to Jordan and cut down wood, I'm thinking that this was Jericho. Okay. I mean, because from Gilgal to Jericho is a lot longer haul. Okay. To the Jordan River. From Samaria to the Jordan River is a pretty good haul. But as we know, you know, Jericho was pretty close proximity to the Jordan River. Now, it could have been others, but my best guess would be that it was Jericho. And they said, sure. Elisha said, sure, go build. They said, we want you to come with us. Why? I don't know. It does not appear that Elisha was a builder by trade. But, you know, maybe they wanted his blessing, you know, his presence, they thought, you know, would help. Maybe they just wanted, we can talk with you while we work. If you're going to be here, we want to, you know, redeem the time. But he went with them. Verse 5, as one was felling a beam, the axe head fell in the water. So what does that mean? It means the axe head was loose and he didn't tighten it. Any of you used an old school axe with a wooden handle? I mean, I have, the first time or two I tried to use it, I did not understand what I should be looking for. So I don't know that I've had it, you know, sling off like that, but I have had it, you know, kind of cock half on and half off. Well, what do I do now? I didn't know you could, at first when I started, I didn't know you could drive a nail or a wedge in there to kind of split the wood, make it grip. So, you know, then I'm trying to use it with a loose head, and because, you know, all manner of problems ensue from that. So apparently, he was inexperienced with an axe. We also see that, you know, he would make a good parallel to a modern day Bible college student, because he said, alas, master, it was borrowed. He didn't have the money to buy his own. But, I mean, what is, I think, driving this is not just the fact that, you know, he lost it, but if he borrowed it, he's going to have to replace it, right? If he didn't have the money to buy one to start with, he didn't have the money to replace one. So there's a lot of pressures, internal pressures for this young man building up. The man of God said, where fell it? And he showed him the place. And he cut down a stick and cast it in thither. All right? I've done that before. You probably have too. Pick up a stick, break off a stick, throw it in the water. All right? How many of you ever done that? Okay, what usually happens with the stick? Does it sink to the bottom? It floats. Okay? All right? Have you ever thrown a stick in the water and had fish come to it? Not usually. I've seen, if it sits there long enough, I've seen a few kind of, you know, nibble at it if they're really hungry or something, or if it's in a pond where they're expecting to be fed, there's movement on the top and they come, you know, thinking maybe that it's food. But you know, nothing unusual happens. What I'm saying is there was nothing natural about throwing a stick in the water and retrieving the head. This was a miracle. This was a supernatural act of God. Elisha throws a stick in the water and it says the iron did swim. Okay, if you picture the axe head sprouting little arms and legs and, you know, doing the dog paddle, you've got the wrong idea, okay? What does that mean? It means it floated, okay? That is within the boundaries of, you know, what this terminology means. And, you know, sometimes if you have a literal mindset like I do, it can get you into trouble. But no, it wasn't doing the backstroke, the breaststroke, or anything else. It floated. And he said, all right, go get it. He went and got it. I mean, that the fact that somebody lost an axe head in the river and they were able to retrieve it, would that make the Shelby Star? Probably not. I mean, on the grand scheme of things, which was a bigger miracle? You know, that was this on the grand scheme of things, is this the largest monetary value? You know, how about giving the Shunammite woman a son when she didn't have one? How about raising a boy from the dead? How about healing a terminal disease, leprosy? How about, you know, providing bread or when, maybe it was the same group, maybe it was different, when the Bible college students, modern day terminology, when the sons of the prophets cut poison mushrooms and put it in the soup and they said, now we can't eat it? I mean, in the grand scheme of things, this doesn't seem all that significant, right? You lost your axe head, you found it. You know, you broke a tool, you fixed it. What's the significance? Well, I think there's a couple of things, but one of the things I see here is that God does indeed take care of the little things. You know, it doesn't have to be that, you know, we need $100,000 or $1 million, or as we're going to see in the end of chapter 6, we're surrounded by an enemy army and we need a miracle of deliverance. You know, it's just as fine to say, well, I mean, I don't have the college students in here, but I would tell them, God cares if you need some quarters to do your laundry, you know, as much as he cares, you know, if you got bad news from the inspector and you got structural repair that needs to be done and, you know, thousands of dollars in expense. So, you know, the Lord took care of that. I mean, it may not be a big deal to you and me. I guarantee it was a big deal to the guy that lost it. It's interesting to me that term borrowed is the same term that we see in Exodus when God was getting ready to do the Passover. He told Moses to instruct the people to borrow from the Egyptians. That word is the word that means to ask for. Okay, when we hear borrow modern day, we think, okay, I'm going to use it and I'm going to return it. It just simply means to ask for. But he had asked for, he had kind of begged for the use of this thing, and you know, it was a big deal to him to have it back. I've heard several messages. I won't try to re-preach one like that today, but I think there certainly is a pretty good application here that when he realized he lost the axe head, he quit swinging the handle. You know, he was smart enough not to continue to take the axe handle and just try to beat the tree down with it. Now, some of you are looking at me like, duh. And that's fair. But, you know, what would the spiritual application of that be? The spiritual parallel of that would be going through the motions with no effectiveness, no power, no profitable result. You say, well, you know, that's good. You know, I'm sure there's some people that need to hear it. Yeah, there's probably some people that are here for Sunday school and Sunday morning and Sunday night and Wednesday night. We need to be reminded of that every once in a while, don't we? Because if we get to the point where we know the system, sometimes we just do the system. But what would the application of that be? You know, if I know I'm out of fellowship with God, I'm not going to just try to keep pretending, going through the motions. I need to find the axe head, you know. If I know I don't have God's direction, I need to find God's direction before, you know, I take another swing at this thing. There's obviously a lot of ways that it could be applied. But at least he had the sense enough to look for the axe head and put it back on before he tried to continue with the work, right? But God cares about the big things. God cares about the little things. That brings us then to, chapter 6, verse number 8, in what we would consider to be a much bigger deal. But God saw fit to record both of these instances in Scripture. For 2 Kings 6, verse number 8, the king of Syria warred against Israel, took counsel with his servants, saying, "In such and such a place shall be my camp." The man of God sent unto the king of Israel, saying, "Beware thou pass not such a place, for thither the Syrians are come down." The king of Israel sent to the place where the man of God had told him and warned him of, and saved himself there not once or twice. Okay? So, that leads us to a question. Who's the spy? Verse 11, "Therefore the heart of the king of Syria was sore troubled for this thing, and he called his servants and said unto them, 'Will you not show me which of us is for the king of Israel?'" Can I translate that for you? Which one of you is a spy? Or which one of our people is a spy? That was the only explanation he could think of. What's the story here? Syria is trying to attack Israel. Elisha is warned of God. Elisha, in turn, tells the king of Israel. Now, who's the king of Israel at this point? One of Ahab's sons. He was helping his people, even though it was, to use our terminology, not a candidate for whom he would have voted. You know, this was not a godly regime, if you want to say it that way. None of the kings of Israel were godly. They were all idolaters. And yet, he was helping him. He sent and warned him multiple times. So the king of Syria says, we got to find the spy. Now, verse number 12 is really interesting. Because we know that's the case, but I want to know how they knew this. How did the Syrians know this answer? You ever think about that? Verse 12, one of the servants said, "None, my lord, O king." In other words, we don't have a spy. "But Elisha, the prophet that is in Israel, telleth the king of Israel the words that thou speakest in thy bedchamber." What would the modern day terminology be for us? Your room is bugged. Right? You're under surveillance. Wear a tinfoil hat. Yeah. You know, but how did they know that it was Elisha? Is this given, now granted, these all things are all kind of lumped together, but in sequence, is this given before or after the story of Naaman? It's very possible. I mean, Naaman would have been well known. He's the captain of the host. He's the leader of the army. So he goes back to Syria. Whoa, look at Naaman. He found the fountain of youth. He's got child skin. How did he get healed from this leprosy? Oh, there's this guy down there. There's this prophet down there in Israel. His name's Elisha. Don't you think Naaman started talking about him? Don't you think the word got around? Obviously, Elisha has done other things as well. There were people that traveled back and forth for commerce or whatever. So stories would travel back and forth as well. But it's very interesting. This is almost, it's not quite the same as when Gideon went down to the edge of the host and heard the dream interpreted, but it's kind of similar to me. Verse 13. And he said, this is the king of Syria still speaking, go and spy where he is, that I may send and fetch him. And it was told him, saying, behold, he's in Dothan. So they knew where Elisha was staying. I mean, where was Elisha's typical headquarters? I think it was in Samaria, based on, you know, right around the area of Samaria, based on other things that were told throughout. But he was visiting Dothan at this point. Verse 14, therefore sent he thither horses and chariots and a great host, and they came by night and compassed the city about. And when the servant of the man of God was risen early and gone forth, behold, an host encompassed the city, both with horses and chariots. Okay? So apparently they came down during the night. They were close enough, you know, that they could make night maneuvers and such. I understand that geographically Dothan sits on a little bit of a hill. But, you know, there were some ridges around there. But what does the word encompassed mean? Surround. Completely surrounded. So he sent enough soldiers to surround the entire city of Dothan. So the servant gets up in the morning, for whatever reason, maybe he's going to get food for the day, maybe he's got an errand for the day, whatever it is, but he gets up, he walks outside, and you know, maybe he kind of does one of these numbers. Maybe he's not trusting what he's seeing. That's not good. Right? That's not good. So he goes back to Elisha. And the last phrase of verse 15, his servant said unto him, alas, my master, how shall we do? Okay, so Syria surrounds Dothan. Notice verse number 16. And he answered, this is Elisha speaking, fear not. It's a little late for that, don't you think? I'm already scared. So this is a command to stop fearing. Now, is that helpful? I mean, your kid comes to you and they're trembling and you said, you know, don't be afraid. And they're like, okay. I mean, for you, hey, just calm down. It'll be okay. Sure, whatever. It doesn't work that way. But why would it be given in the form of a command? Yes, it is a command from God. Why would God give us a command? Because God would give us a command because this is a choice that we can make. I can choose to trust God intentionally despite my feelings, or I can choose to let my feelings dictate my actions. Okay? So there's a sense in which, you know, fear is a feeling, but you understand there's another sense in which fear is related to our choices. Okay? Just like faith is choosing to trust God and seeing how it works out later, so there are times when I'm going to choose to trust God and let the feelings catch up later when it comes to fear as well. He said, fear not. Now notice the rest of verse number 16. They that be with us are more than they that be with them. Now, at this point, do you think the servant thought he was a little bit crazy? One, two. Dothan was not a huge city. But if there's chariots around, there were also foot soldiers. I mean, there was an entire army here surrounding them. And he's counting, saying, in case you failed math class, we're outnumbered. Verse 17, what does Elisha say? Elisha prayed and said, Lord, I pray thee, open his eyes that he may see. And the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire round about Elisha. Psalm 27:3 says this, though a host should encamp against me, my heart shall not fear. Though war should rise against me, in this will I be confident. Elisha's got a pretty good opportunity to put that into practice right here, doesn't he? A host is definitely encamped against him. But what was the difference? God's protection was there. 2 Chronicles 32:7 says, be strong and courageous. Be not afraid nor dismayed for the king of Assyria. This is Hezekiah, 2 Chronicles 32. For all the multitude that is with him, for there be more with us than with him. Verse 17, the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire round about Elisha. Where have we seen that phrase, chariots of fire, in this context? Horses and chariots of fire. Where have we seen that in 2 Kings? Yeah. When Elijah was caught up with the whirlwind, there was also the appearance of chariots and horses of fire. Now, the Bible says the whirlwind caught him up to heaven, but it sure seems like that chariots and horses of fire represents God's presence, or the presence of God's messengers, right? So now you have chariots and horses of fire that were not visible to the human eye naturally. So, but in other words, God had given Elisha bodyguards. That'd be a good way to say it. God had given Elisha protection. Why was Elisha calm when the servant was not? He had a better understanding of God's protection, God's provision. You know, sometimes we pray, Lord, would you strike the enemy dead? Maybe sometimes we just need to pray, Lord, would you help me to see how you're working in this situation? Lord, would you help me to see what you're already doing, because I'm focusing on the problem instead of your protection, your provision. Here, Elisha said, Lord, would you open his eyes? Now, obviously his eyes were open. They were working because he saw the enemy host, right? It's not that he was blind. It's just that there was some perception that he lacked. That same thing is going to be true of the army. We're not going to get to that part today, but Elisha said, Lord, would you smite him with blindness? And in essence, it was that God dulled their perception. They did not recognize who they were talking to, and he led them away from Dothan and, led them out of the city. But here, the servant did not have the same perception that Elisha did. So what do I look at that and say, well, some people got it and some people don't. Did God open the eyes of the servant? Yeah. So what should I pray then? What can you pray? Lord, would you help me to have the discernment that I ought to have? Would you help me to see your working where I don't recognize it? Lord, would you help me to see things from your perspective when I'm on a purely, human level of perception? Yeah, I think that'd be a great lesson for us to learn from Elisha's servant here. Did Elisha rebuke him? No. He just said, well, there's some things you don't understand yet. And he said there's another step of growth here that's needed. Thank the Lord that he works with us on things like that, right? All right, we've got to quit there. We're out of time for today. Thank you, Lord, for your word.